As for the man, he's about 52. Of humble origin, there are still traces of Cockney in his voice. Ugly as a chimpanzee, but so radiant, he emanates more love than any man I've ever known, that as soon as he begins talking, whether in private or in a lecture, he is transfigured and looks like an angel. He sweeps some people quite off their feet and has many disciples. Women find him so attractive that if he were a bad man, he could do what he liked, either as a Don Juan or a charlatan. This is Pints with Jack, Season 7, Episode 21, Jack's Bookshelf. Charles Williams, After Hours with Serena Higgins. Welcome everyone. Here on Pints with Jack, we're reading our way through the works of C.S. Lewis. But this month, we've been snooping through Jack's bookshelf, looking at the authors and books which shaped the life and writing of C.S. Lewis. And today we wrap things up with an author who was a contemporary of Lewis, also a friend and also a fellow Inkling, Charles Williams. And to help us navigate this complex, bizarre, interesting character, I'm joined by Serena Higgins. Serena Higgins is an editor, writer, English teacher, and scholar of British modernist literature. In 2022, she founded the Signum University Press and worked as its first editor-in-chief. She has taught courses in literature, creative writing, and academic writing for over two decades in a variety of settings. She is a writing consultant over at Word Horde, and you can hire her to help you with your writing. She previously edited an academic essay collection entitled The Inklings and King Arthur. She is also the author of the blog The Oddest Inkling, which is devoted to a systematic study of Charles Williams's work. And Dr. Higgins is currently writing From Thaumaturgy to Dramaturgy, Staging Occult Modernism, as well as The Oddest Inkling, An Introduction to Charles Williams, which is due out in 2024 from Apocryphal Press. Serena Higgins, welcome to Pints with Jack.
Thank you very much for having me here. I'm delighted to hang out with you and talk about this strange but engaging writer.
Strange but engaging. Yes, I think that's a really good description. We'll get to Charles Williams in a moment. It's been a couple of months since you and I have talked. What have you been up to recently?
Oh, I've been developing that consultancy that you mentioned in your bio, editing a lot of really engaging works and enjoying working with clients. And most excitingly and most relevant for this podcast, I've started writing The Oddest Inkling, An Introduction to Charles Williams. You and many of your listeners know that I've been blogging through Williams' works for years, and I'm finally turning that blog content into a book. It'll be an introductory level, non-academic, popular work for anyone who has never read Williams' books or who would like a little extra guidance to understand him more thoroughly.
I noted last year that there was a new introductory volume for Owen Barfield, and he is also a very strange and interesting person. An introduction to him was well overdue, and the next obvious candidate is Charles Williams, to have some kind of introductory text to hold people's hands as they enter his weird and wonderful world, because it's kind of scary.
Absolutely. I would have enjoyed having one myself when I first encountered his books.
Well, I am currently enjoying a Best Day Brewing beer, a West Coast IPA. Despite me messing up the recording initially, I would like to assure everyone that it is currently non-alcoholic, so that cannot be blamed for the mistakes. That's just me. are you drinking anything?
I have an orange-flavored Earl Grey tea. Earl Grey with some orange peel in, sweetened with honey, and a little oat milk.
Wow. I would have never thought of putting orange in Earl Grey. I've always put lemon.
Well, it already has bergamot in it, right? So All the citrus family together.
Okay. All right. I'm going to have to give that a go. Well, cheers.
Cheers to you too.
So, Charles Williams, the man. Would you mind just sketching out his background for us?
Sure. He was a little bit different than the rest of the Inklings in a few ways. He was a city boy, born in a suburb of London and lived most of his life in the city. So he was not one of these inveterate country walkers like the rest of the Inklings. He saw the glory and the beauty underneath the chaos of a cityscape. He also was from a fairly poor family, and they were unable to afford a university education for him. So he only had a couple of semesters of university, and beyond that was largely self-taught. He also is not a professional academic. He was an editor by trade, but again, not by training, really self-taught. He got a lowly job as a proofreader at the Oxford University Press at a young age, and then worked his way up the ranks to become a senior editor there at the press. And he actually had a lot to do with shaping the reading tastes of his times through the anthologies he put together, introductions and prefaces he wrote, authors he introduced to the public, editions that he edited, and so forth. So he was quite the well-read man in his own right, had a brilliant photographic memory, and as I say, had a great influence on readers and writers after him as well.
Hmm. How did he and C.S. Lewis get into contact with each other?
Oh, that's a beautiful story. They had a lovely, well, he wouldn't call it a coincidence. Charles Williams called it the staff work of the omnipotence. So in his work at the press, Williams was editing one of C.S. Lewis's books, and Williams actually chose the title for it, The Allegory of Love. You may have heard of it. Mm-hmm. And while Williams was correcting the proofs of that book, Lewis was reading his first Williams work that was lent to him by Neville Coghill. It was the novel, The Place of the Lion. And Lewis was astonished by this book. And in his enthusiasm, he dashed off a fan letter to Williams full of high praise, saying how much he enjoyed this book and how much it opened his eyes to new ideas. Williams wrote back almost immediately and said that he was astounded by The Allegory of Love and said, if you had delayed writing another 24 hours, our letters would have crossed in the mail. My admiration for the staff work of the omnipotence rises every day. So they met by letter. And then when either of them was in London or Oxford subsequently, they would get together for a meal. And then in 1939, Williams's office was evacuated from London to Oxford to avoid the bombing during the Blitz. And so then he was an in-person member of the Inklings for the last 6 years of his life.
That's quite a brag, really. Charles Williams could say, I correct the work of C.S. Lewis. I'm his editor, at least. And also, I get fan letters from the person you send fan letters to.
Oh, yes. And he indeed did like to brag about those things and would write braggy letters home to his wife about how he was becoming such good friends with T.S. Eliot.
Well, what makes him such an important author and an important member of the Inklings?
Yes, there are a few things. He was the best poet among the group by far, when it comes to his technical virtuosity. His poetry is very difficult. T.S. Eliot said he found it hard to understand, which is saying something. Mm-hmm. By the end of his life, at least, he was the greatest master of verse. But he also hobnobbed with the mainstream modernists more than the other Inklings. I already mentioned Eliot. He knew W.H. Auden, he corresponded with William Butler Yeats, and also some of the younger generation of modernists. So I think he brought an important perspective outside of the ivory towers of Oxbridge academia, London city man, a working class person. And then he also brought to the Inklings his deep-rooted mysticism, and we'll get into that, perhaps even magic, that went beyond what the others practiced. Now, of course, there are debates over whether C.S. Lewis was himself a mystic or not. He certainly portrays mystical experience in his books, but there is no question that Charles Williams was a highly trained mystic himself and that that was an essential part of his life. So those are some of the contributions that he makes to the Inklings. And then as far as why is he an important writer? Well, certain of his works have always had a cult following, a small but impassioned fan base, and I think that that's growing as more people discover his works. They're bizarre, they're strange, they're difficult to read at first, but they bring the supernatural to life and put the supernatural into contact with the natural in a way that very few other writers can achieve.
And what about for yourself? When did you first come across him and what was it that got you hooked?
Yes, so I came across him right after graduating from my bachelor's degree. My favorite professor there kept saying that I should read Charles Williams, and I didn't make time to do so until I think it was the Christmas break after graduation or so. And I felt what Emily Dickinson has called the top of your head lifted off by great writing. And like Lewis, it was The Place of the Lion. It was just unlike anything that I'd read before. Someone could make the otherworldly so real and vivid, painted in vivid colors that I could picture and integrated with ordinary lives in a way that seemed not impossible to accomplish or to experience oneself.
We'll speak about how Williams influenced Lewis in a little bit, but do we know what books and authors really shaped him?
We do. His reading was vast and omnivorous, but also unsystematic, thanks to his not having the regular university degree. But the authors who influenced the most were probably Virgil and Dante, to a very great degree. Then a writer that very few of us read nowadays, a Victorian author called Coventry Patmore, together with Dante, Coventry Patmore showed Williams a path of romantic love that is not really practiced among your common average everyday Christian, but it's the idea that one can be so transformed by romantic love and by the experience of falling in love and by the glorious vision of the beloved that one can use that as a path to God, essentially seeing more of who God is through the overwhelming passion of the early stages of a love affair. He also was highly influenced by Gerard Manley Hopkins. In the 1930s, he got to edit the second edition of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poems, and he was personally requested by Robert Bridges, who was Hopkins' good friend and executor, and had edited the first edition. We can see a distinct change in Williams' poetry after he edited Hopkins, a change for the better. He moves from sort of an Edwardian kind of pastiche to a much stronger, leaner rhythm as poetry is better after that. All of the other sort of syllabus of British poets influenced him as well, but those are probably the biggest names.
Hearing his connection to Gerard Manley Hopkins makes me very happy because he's definitely one of my favorite poets.
Oh, mine too.
It's funny, knowing that they knew each other makes me a little less scared of him.
They didn't meet in person though, unfortunately, but Williams was very good friends and then rivals and then office mates with Jerry Hopkins, the poet's nephew.
Oh, okay. And the connection with Dante, I seem to recall, didn't he set Dorothy L. Sayers on a path to loving Dante and doing her own translation?
He absolutely did. Yep, she totally credits him for helping her to fall in love with Dante and begin on that great life's work of her own.
Hmm. Well, speaking of great life's work, just give us a bit of a sketch of Williams's key works.
Sure. It's a little hard to do because he wrote in so many genres. He wrote very quickly. The man hardly ever slept, and he carried around little pads of paper, and he would write on his knee wherever he was, in a bus, in a subway, in his handwriting that was already very shaky, and then he's in a moving vehicle. So yay for those of us who have to transcribe his works in an archive. But he wanted first and foremost to be a great poet, as did each of the Inklings. But as I say, I think he came closest to achieving that of the bunch. And his life's work was the King Arthur story. He worked for decades on various versions of King Arthur poetry. And finally, late in life, he published two volumes of Arthurian poetry, Taliesin through Logres in 1938 and The Region of the Summer Stars in 1944. He was working on additional Arthurian poems when he died to be called either The Advent of Galahad or Jupiter over Carbonek. And this past October, in the Marion E. Wade Center, I found folders of previously unpublished Arthurian poetry under those titles. So stay tuned. He also wrote seven novels or spiritual shockers or metaphysical thrillers. They're kind of like if Frank Peretti were actually a very good literary writer. But those are just beautiful, bizarre novels in which some otherworldly force breaks into our world and transforms it. He also wrote literary criticism and biographies and sort of quasi-history books like A History of Witchcraft and A History of the Work of the Holy Spirit in the Church. He wrote lay theology, which overlapped with his literary criticism, because for him, everything was such a whole. He saw it holistically. He couldn't really separate his theological work from his literary work from his life. And finally, what he was maybe best known for in his lifetime, and which I'm trying to somewhat revive knowledge of now, is that he wrote plays. He wrote a lot of plays on direct commission for performance. He wrote the Canterbury Festival play the year after T.S. Eliot's murder in the cathedral. Dorothy L. Sayers also contributed two plays to that festival. And he wrote a lot of ecclesiastical drama, some of which was put on tour and went on the road around England and was played for a wide variety of audiences. So that should give you some idea of how prolific he was and how varied his works, but they were always infused with his unique holistic vision of the natural and what he called the arch natural being impinging upon one another.
Let's tiptoe into that area. I mean, what was his worldview? Because every single description I hear about him, it sounds like a weird mishmash, some things that sound closely Orthodox Christianity and other things that definitely do not sound like it. What was his worldview? How did he see things?
His worldview was correspondence and coherence. And the first of those terms, correspondence, comes from various Hermetic or occult traditions. And it actually comes from a sentence in the Corpus Hermeticum, which is a set of putative ancient documents probably forged in the Middle Ages. And they talk about how everything here below in the material world is a copy or a shadow or an index of something in the macrocosm or the spiritual world. So as above, so below. So you can study everything here in this material world as an index of something in the noumenal realm, whether it's the human body. So every part of the human body represents some virtue or some heavenly quality, or whether it's geography and topography, you can look at those as representing spiritual realities, or on and on and on. Everything is symbolic, perhaps would be one way you could summarize that side of his worldview. And he developed that from his many years, probably 20 years membership in two different Hermetic groups, one of which he was in for 10 years and became a master of the temple there. And that was the more Christian mystical group. And the other of which was a little more unofficial. And he was in it for about 20 years. And that was the more magical occult of the groups. But in both of these, he practiced high ceremonies and rituals designed essentially to understand the symbols and to bring the symbolized together with its symbol, or maybe I should have said that the other way around, to bring the macrocosm in touch with the microcosm. It's funny that you said he believed a mishmash. He would have thought the exact opposite. For him, it was that everything is interrelated and everything can be mapped onto everything else. And literally, that's what he tried to do in his Arthurian poetry. Your listeners, if they don't know it, should look up his map drawn by Linton Lamb. That was the frontispiece for Taliesin through Logres. And it shows a map of Europe with the drawing of a woman's figure over it. And in his poetry, you can pick any one point on the map, and it has many, many layers of symbolism. It's a body part. It's a geographical region. It's a sign of the zodiac. It's one of the spheres on the Sephirotic tree, which is appropriated from Kabbalism, Kabbalah. It's a spiritual virtue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the correspondence side of his worldview. Do you want me to go on to the coherence side, or did you want to ask anything about that one first?
We will be returning to Charles Williams, I think probably next season, because George MacDonald is getting his month at the end of this season. I think we're going to have Charles Williams next season, and we'll dig into these in more detail.
Good.
I just really wanted to make sure that we talk about Charles Williams a little bit, because much like MacDonald, much like Barfield, I've been horrified at how long we've gone through talking about Lewis without actually even barely mentioning this other inkling who formed a great influence on him, which is why I'm cheating and getting this in now. But we will come back to all of these all of these issues and dig into them in more detail. And I've actually not read any Charles Williams book cover to cover. By the time we come to the Charles Williams month, that will have changed. I'm scared, but it's going to be great. But no, let's push on. Let's talk about coherence. Yes, let's talk about coherence, because this is a Charles Williams idea that has resonated with me the most whenever I've read about it. And particularly when I was reading Till We Have Faces, that was the thing that jumped out at me.
Yes.
In part two, it was like, oh, I know what he's doing here. So would you mind explaining, what is this?
So coherence is his other major idea. And as you said at the beginning, some of his ideas seem more orthodox and some seem less so. So the correspondence seems less so, unless you happen to be a Christian Platonist, right? The coherence perhaps seems more so, but I argue that it is actually the more magical of the ideas. It is the belief that we are all members of one another. We all influence one another in deep and profound ways beyond those that we can see. It's founded on the idea of the Trinity and the perichoresis, that the three members of the Christian Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, are engaged in an eternal dance with one another, that the three figures are dancing in and out of one another, and that they create a community of love and of mutual exchange. Therefore, because we are created by God in the image of God, all of us humans interact in an ongoing dance, which can either, based on our choice, be a dance of mutual exchange and submission and service, or we can fight against that and reject that. Our entire lives, we can be kicking against trying to get out of that dance and trying to reject service and submission to others. Because of his doctrine of coherence, he was able then to create a praxis or a practice of the way of substitution or the doctrine of exchange. And that's the idea that I could take on some spiritual, mental, emotional burden for you just as easily as if you've been carrying a heavy box and you're tired, I could say, here, let me carry that box for you for a little while. And you could very easily hand it over if we weren't, you know, meeting over the internet. Perhaps a way to understand his doctrine of substitution is I could carry the box for you even over the internet.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's a way of thinking about it, because to us, that's utterly impossible. But he believed that if I heard that you had just had some horrible grief, you just lost someone you loved, or you'd just gotten a terminal diagnosis or some other horrible trauma in your life, he believed that I could basically hold out my hand, spiritually speaking, and take it for you. And you wouldn't feel the burden of that grief or trauma anymore. You would still be able to function, and I would carry it for you, but it would be lighter for me because it's not my burden. And then I've heard some people say that really what happens is that the recipient then passes the burden along to Christ because he already carried all the burdens on the cross. But Williams doesn't say it that way. Mm-hmm. That's making it a little bit more orthodox. That's taming it a little bit more than Williams himself would say.
Or perhaps grounding it in something. Because my question is, if you took Christ out of that, what allows this to happen? What is the medium through which this actually takes place?
So Williams answers that question in one of his novels, Descent into Hell, the second to last novel. There's a young woman who has a terror, an ongoing horrific fear in her life. And she meets the Charles Williams stand-in character, Peter Stanhope. And he offers to carry her fear for her. And she thinks this is nonsense. She's like, what are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense. And he said, that's the way the universe is constructed. I didn't make the universe and it's not my fault. But you can accept the nature of the universe or you can fight against it. And he quotes from Jesus and he quotes from St. Paul. And then he says, and this is to get to your question, David, he says, but you needn't bring Jesus and St. Paul into it if you don't want to. So in other words, because it's the nature of the universe, like this is just the way things are made. So whether you believe in Christ or not, whether you accept any part of the Christian story or not, he says, this is just the way that things are made. And he says that even in his word, pagans are practicing this all the time in practical ways, like the farmer harvests the grain, I eat the bread. That is an act of substitution and exchange. You make something, I pay you for it, and I buy it. That money is a medium of exchange. So he says, this is just the way things work. And you can accept that, or you can fight against that and strive for solipsism and independence.
I suppose that makes sense, given what you've said earlier about his belief about everything being connected and symbols and divine realities. It seems like so much of this is rooted in his conception of reality itself.
It is.
That makes all of these things possible.
Right. So that's why a rejection of what might seem like a slightly odd and eccentric doctrine, you know, the doctrine of exchange, to him is a rejection of the nature of reality. And therefore, it's the most hellish act, literally, that a person could commit, because it's kicking away reality and saying, I will be the ultimate reality. I will separate myself from everything else and everyone else, and I will be a world unto myself. And that's what happens in the titular action, the descent into hell from that novel. There's a character who chooses self over other over and over and over. To the point that, okay, adult content warning, to the point that he actually gives birth to an incubus himself instead of the woman that he has lusted after, and then proceeds to isolate himself in his house and try to satisfy his lusts on this self-born creature over and over and over and over until eventually he sinks into this hideous self-involved dream and he continues crawling down into hell over and over and over by his own choice because he wants to refuse anyone else having joy and he just wants to consume. And so he's self-focused.
Wow. I think it was prettier Until We Have Faces with, you know, another ball, nearly all the anguish. But that's definitely vivid.
It was indeed a little prettier. But maybe one way of comparing the two is that that vision of hell is very much like the unguent vision Until We Have Faces, right? The large, the loaf-like lump that's just absorbing and devouring. And yet it is real. It does have real spiritual power. There's a character called Lilith in Descent into Hell who's sort of an Unget figure in a way.
Hmm. Connections are going in my head all over things like the Great Divorce as well, with the way people ultimately become nothing because they turn inwards rather than outwards. So this is a natural transition to Williams's influence on C.S. Lewis and the Inklings more broadly. You've spoken a little bit about that he would have been their sort of gateway into a lot of modernist literature. How else did he influence them?
Yes, unfortunately, he was only with them for those last 6 years of his life. It was very sad. He was planning to stay in Oxford from then on, and they were very good for him, and I think he was good for them. But there are many ways that are hard to track because he was such a good friend to all of them. One of his social abilities was to bring out the best in the other person to whom he was speaking. People said that after talking to him, they went away feeling much more intelligent and witty and beautiful and valuable. He would take some little hint that they said and catch it up into his conversation and make them sound like geniuses as he played with the idea that they suggested. So he added a kind of a spark. He set fire, I think, to some of the Inklings' conversations and brought it in directions it never would have gone. And he pushed them beyond the bounds of orthodoxy to consider ideas that they probably wouldn't have considered otherwise. Lewis writes in a letter to his brother Warney that another minor Inkling, Charles Wren, the other night, almost seriously expressed a desire to burn Williams as a heretic, or at least said that friendship with Charles Williams enabled him to understand why people did want to burn others as heretics. So he was good for them that way. I think maybe he challenged some of their snobbery because he did come from a lower class and had that Cockney accent and wasn't Oxbridge educated. And yet, Lewis also writes, until Charles came, I was our greatest conduit for quotations, but he quickly outstripped me. So they were very good for each other. Personally, the coherence doctrine impressed Lewis greatly. And when his wife, Joy Davenman, had the cancer, there was one time when the cancer was eating away at the bones of her thigh and she was just in utter agony and Jack was sitting by her bed just weeping that he could take the pain for her. And lo and behold, he got a searing pain in his thigh bone and Joy felt better. And then he was diagnosed with osteoporosis, which is the calcium leaching out of one's bones. And the doctors said that her bones magically, miraculously regrew. And he wrote in a letter to a friend, one is tempted to suspect a Charles Williams type substitution.
Mm.
So that influenced him profoundly. You've mentioned Till We Have Faces, which I think shows the best of the Williams influence. Mm. It's more explicit in That Hideous Strength. It has been called a C.S. Lewis novel by Charles Williams. It is a mishmash, right? I'm not sure Lewis managed to unite all the elements perhaps as well as Charles might have. But the figure of Merlin is a direct steal, perhaps, from Williams's Arthuriad. The character of Ransom, readers may note, is quite different in that book from the first two volumes of the Ransom cycle. And he's basically a portrait of Charles Williams as people tended to see him, this radiant, glowing, charismatic figure who drew other people, especially young women, towards him with this irresistible charm. And yet there's something kind of creepy and otherworldly about him. And then there are some genre influences. There's a great book by Sanford Schwartz called C.S. Lewis on the Final Frontier that does a really good job of looking at Williams' influences on That Hideous Strength. And Charles Hutter also has an article on that topic in, I think it was in Seven. It may have been in Mythlore. But anyway, there's some direct influences there.
Yeah. When we come back to do Charles Williams Month, we will dedicate some time to Charles's odd and sometimes rather creepy relationships with women. We'll put a pin in that one for now. But to sort of wrap things up, if someone has never read Charles Williams, how do they begin? And I'm asking this very personally because I've already promised that I'm going to change this by the next time we speak.
Well, they begin by going to my blog, theoddestinkling.wordpress.com, and right across the top, they'll see Reader's Guide. And so I have there a Reader's Guide for Beginners in which I go through suggestions. And it really depends on your favorite genre. So for most people, I recommend starting with the novels. But what do you prefer to read? Novels, plays, theology, poetry, literary criticism?
Lewis has sort of broken me on that one. Previously, I'd have always said nonfiction, but Lewis's fiction is has become the most important part of his work for me. I've got over the snobbery of going, it's just a made-up story. What could that possibly teach me?
Phew, glad you got over that.
Well, yes, it had to happen eventually, although I think my grandfather would be very disappointed. He was certainly a man that only ever read non-fiction, and he thought that fiction was kind of a waste of time. But yeah, I would say fiction is probably a good place for me to start.
Great, and probably for most people, right? Unless someone is a very avid reader of modernist verse like T.S. Eliot, or if they're really well read in the Arthurian tradition, probably start with the novels. And then of the novels, do not start with Shadows of Ecstasy. People call it the first novel. It was published fourth, but he wrote it first. It is the weirdest. It is the most disturbing. It is the least well-written. So don't start with that one. You could start with The Place of the Lion, like I did and like Lewis did. Or you might want to start with War in Heaven, because it's the one that has something most resembling a plot, which can be helpful. it's a lively, delightful. It starts out as a murder mystery, but then the murderer confesses on page 25. So you're like, what is this book? And then it turns into a fight for the Holy Grail, not a quest, because they have it, but a fight for possession of the Holy Grail. It's just utterly delightful. And the syntax is less labyrinthine in this one than it is in some. Mm-hmm. And then it's nice because it also has a sequel, Many Dimensions. So if you like it, it can then draw you into the other novels. That's where you might want to start.
If somebody wants to start with his poetry, what kind of collections are there?
Yeah, he published many volumes of verse. He was, as I said, very prolific. But they don't really get very good until the mid to late 30s. One could start with his 1930 collection, Heroes and Kings, because it's just a shorter collection. It's got a variety of pieces in it, including some Arthurian works, but it's also very disturbing. So maybe just jump into his two great volumes, Taliesin Through Logres and The Region of the Summer Stars. There's an Apocryphal Press edition for which I wrote an introduction to Taliesin, in which I give some suggestions about how to approach his poetry. And I found it helpful on a first read to experience it like music, not trying to understand it, but to listen to it and enjoy the sounds and the aesthetic pleasures.
Okay. And lastly, if we wanted to dive into some of his theological thought, maybe where would one begin?
Yeah, He Came Down from Heaven is a fairly straightforward one. It's a sort of a beautiful and compelling book. His great theological literary critical work is The Figure of Beatrice. So a brave reader or someone who is a professional in theology or literature could jump straight into that.
Excellent. Well, my year challenge reading, so previously I've done the Bible in a year a couple of times, catechism in a year. This year I'm going through the Quran, but it's fairly short, so I'm going to have some spare time. And so I'm going to finally finish off Dante's Divine Comedy. And so hopefully that should stand me in better stead for when I return to Charles later in the year.
Well, then read his short little essay on Dante, Religion and Love in Dante, I think it's called. That might be a nice place for you then, particularly.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we could meet and for me to get this personalized plan of trying to read Charles Williams, and hopefully other people will gain something from our interview. Serena Higgins, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, and holler when you have questions. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I love talking about this strange writer.
As the landlord rings the bell for final drinks, can you please tell us where people can go to find out more about you and your work?
Sure. They can go to sorinahiggins.com. That's sorinahiggins.com. A lot of different links there. They can link out to the Word Horde Writing Consultancy if they'd like me to help them work on their own pieces. And then, of course, Oddest Inkling is the place where they can find my Williams work.
Wonderful. Well, thanks to our sound engineers, Taylor and Sarah. Thanks to our intern, Julia. Thanks to all of our listeners and patron supporters, particularly our top tier supporters, Mary Margaret, Aldo, Alex, James, Matt, Erica, Joelle, Amanda, Thomas, Bud, Shane, Kay, Paul, Gary, Stephen, Kelly, Chris, John, James, Kate, Peter, David, Angela, and Rowdy. We pray for our listeners every week, particularly on Tuesdays, offering up all the prayer requests in our Slack channel. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please try picking up a Charles Williams novel and let me know how you go. This is going to be some fun reading ahead. I'm excited. So please join us again next time when we'll continue going further up
and further in.
Cheers.
Cheers.